Hello, everybody. This is the Friday Night Talk with Inner Space. I'm Artie, and it's my pleasure to say hello and welcome you. Today's talk is The Courage to Be Disliked, Succeeding as You Are. And our speaker is zooming in from Miami. Kathleen Sia, is that right? I didn't ask you how to pronounce your name.
No, it's Shay.
Shay, oh my goodness.
Shay.
Kathleen Shay is a social scientist based in Miami, Florida, where it's lovely and warm, well, hot and sunny. So please do take a bit of that sun with you this evening. Her experience includes university teaching, research, as well as years as a civil rights and gender, civil rights activist and gender equality. So I'm going to hand over to Kathleen. Just before I do that, I'm going to just let you all know that the questions that you would like to put to Kathleen, if you could send it to us via the question and answer link, that would be very helpful. Kathleen or Kathy will be taking your questions at the end of her talk. Enjoy. Kathleen, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, Artie, and let me welcome you all to Miami as well. It is a bright, sunny afternoon here in Miami, and so hope you can take a little breath of the fresh air and warm up with our sunshine. So today's talk is The Courage to Be Disliked, Succeeding as You Are. And when I first heard this topic from Artie, the very first thing that came to mind was a book by a former president of the US by the name of John Kennedy. So I bet many of you know who I'm talking about. But before he was the president, he wrote a book called Profiles in Courage. And it actually won the Pulitzer Prize in 1957. So the book talked about three kinds of courage, and he was writing about political leaders, political courage. And the first kind of courage that he talked about was the courage to be disliked. And the second type was the pressure, really, the three kinds of pressures that took courage. But the second was the pressure to get reelected. And the third one was about handling the pressures from constituents and from special interest groups. But it's that first kind of pressure that spawned the courage that John Kennedy wrote about. It's the courage to be disliked. When we think about the great leaders, political leaders, for example, or social leaders, we always come up with some of the same ones: Martin Luther King, Mandela, Gandhi, and so forth. I would add Susan B. Anthony, who in the US led the charge for an amendment that gave women the right to vote. And there's always an element, as John Kennedy said, there's always an element of being disliked. Anyone who's done some great things in the world has been disliked at some point in their life. And Artie mentioned that I was involved in civil rights and gender equity in the States. And I know in the UK now, this is Black History Month. We have our celebration of Black History Month in February. And here in the USA, one of the civil rights icons just died in the past couple of months, and his name was John Lewis. And he, to me, epitomized the kind of attitude that I want to talk about tonight. So, who doesn't want to be liked? And Kennedy talked about having the courage to be disliked. When I first thought about this topic, I thought, well, I don't know if I have anything to say about it because I honestly can't remember a time or that people disliked me. But then I thought a little bit further of it. And it's true, there were some times when I was disliked, but the flip side of it was more often true, that I spent a lot of time trying to be likable. And John Kennedy wrote this in his book too, that who more than a politician needs to be liked if they want to be effective, if they want to be reelected, and so forth. I was trying very hard to be liked. And I probably wouldn't have admitted it at the time. But over time, you know, we can end up becoming what we aren't. As we try and be likable, as we try to see others and get their approval, or or wanting to please others, and seek their approval over time. So in a way, the end result of that often is that we lose ourselves. And that was kind of my story. So tonight, I wanted to do two things. First of all, share a bit about being disliked, how we get to that point of losing ourselves. And then think about what it is that we would do if we had the courage to be disliked, if we stop trying to meet everyone's expectations, if we stop trying to please my boss or my spouse or my friends, if we stopped being who we're not, and whether we could do it. We need some courage. So I'd like to share a few things that I thought helped me and maybe helped you as well. And during this time, we'll have a few short reflections to give you an opportunity as well. So let me just put my timer on here so I don't kind of lose track of myself. So how does it start, this dislike for ourselves? And this is something that I want to take us back and talk about children for a little bit. For many years, since the late 90s, I was involved in a project called Living Values. Some of you may be familiar with it. It was an initiative started by the Brahma Kumaris. And since that time, it has evolved into its own international global character education program with many countries. I don't even know how many countries anymore, about 90, 100 countries that have implemented this curriculum that was developed by a school psychologist here in the USA in California, Diane Tillman. And over the years, I was a volunteer with them for many years. And I used to do a workshop for parents that was on labeling. And imagine, if you would, how this labeling starts very early in life. And if you've ever heard somebody say, if you have children or maybe you're a twin or something, you heard some your parents say, "Oh, that's a smart one," or she's very the artistic one in the family, or a teacher would say, "It's kind of lazy in class," and kids hear this, they know it. It's almost like walking around. I'm sorry, my camera doesn't mirror, but imagine that I had a name tag on that said smart, you know. That I walked into every classroom or every room with a label that said ugly, you know, imagine. But that's how kids end up feeling. And even if it's unconscious or not malintended, or even if it's a good label like smart, we begin to live into those over time. And I can remember teachers, you know, when kids would pass from one grade to the next, and they would warn the next teacher, "Oh, watch out for him." And so, you know, over time, these labels that we get, often unintentionally, become crystallized, hardened, and ultimately they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in a way, that was my story. I was a product of the 60s. I was an only child. And so I entertain myself a lot. I always was bothered by injustices and being treated, people that were treated unfairly. And so I got a little bit of a reputation as being rebellious. And so in college, when it was the 60s, of course I lived into that. I sat in, I, you know, sat out, I marched, I, you know, I did all, I marched even recently, I'm still marching. And so I got that reputation. I got that label. But even if we received a label like that unconsciously, over time, we begin to think that that's exactly who we are. And so a child, for example, who's labeled a nerd may stop wanting to try other things like athletics things because that's not who he thinks he is. Or a girl who thinks that, you know, she's maybe not the prettiest one in the class. As she gets a little older, she thinks, oh, I'll never get a date. I'll never find a husband. Or a child who's more a ballet, a boy who likes ballet and gets made fun of for not being manly enough. Or conversely, doesn't like football and then gets criticized or made fun of for that. Or they lose interest in sports and prefer to play music, for example. So these are very subtle, but over time, they become a self-fulfilling promise. And children who are fortunate enough to be labeled gifted often live into that. Whereas somebody who was a slow learner also will live into that. Of course, there are actual diagnoses, and I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about impressions, however unconscious, that lead into stereotypes, that lead into policies and regulations that exclude, and then that becomes real racism or sexism or ethnocentrism and so forth. So let me tell you a story, if I may. In that regard, again, when I was working in gender equity and we were working with public school systems who systematically had excluded girls, preteen girls, let's say, from advanced math classes, thinking that they just couldn't handle it. And so it even became a research area where many people were studying this whole phenomenon of math anxiety. And that actually became my dissertation to look at whether this was real and whether it was something that was affected girls only. And for example, did boys have reading anxiety because their scores were typically lower than girls? So, you know, we find that these are stereotypes and they don't really hold true. And once the school system began opening these courses to girls, you see how well they've done. Other countries have been much more open to having girls in the STEM fields. It's much more common to see women engineers, women doctors in other countries than it has been in the USA. And for the first time in the USA, there are more women than men in law school, which is a first. I actually thought about going to law school after my undergraduate years, and I was pretty roundly, I took a semester, a year actually, and I was pretty roundly driven out. And I didn't have the courage to stay the course, and I chose another path in social science, which was more to my liking anyway. So the second way, not thinking about children, but the second way that we may come to dislike ourselves is because of something about us that may be different or something that I don't like about myself, maybe my appearance, but it's something about ourselves, you know, my appearance, Perhaps I have a little disability or a learning disability. Maybe I have some guilt or shame about something that I've done in my life, and I certainly have some regrets. Maybe it's something I've said to somebody. Maybe it's a belief that I've reinforced in myself, like I'm just not cut out for something, or I'll never get married, or it's not meant for me to do this or that. And as I reinforce these beliefs about myself, they harden. And I believe that that's just my personality. And so I think I use that as an excuse to not do something, or to close my heart, not be vulnerable, and distance myself from people. So it just becomes part of my personality. In my own case, I was an aspiring professor. I was teaching, I was, you know, doing some research, I was working, I was trying to be a good professor, I was trying to be a good partner to someone, I was trying to be a good daughter. As an only child, I had a lot of responsibility for caretaking for my parents, and I was exhausted. I was exhausted. And so what happened was that I became woefully unhappy. Even though by all outward appearances, I was successful, I was accomplished, I got my doctorate, I, you know, doing all these things. And I was socially engaged, you know, you could count on me, I was very responsible, but I was so, so unhappy. And lo and behold, one day while I was teaching, I had a stroke. I literally short-circuited myself. And obviously, I'm okay. I recovered. But it changed my life. And so now I call it a stroke of luck. I had a stroke of luck. And there were some friends who were very careful and kind with me, whose help I'll never forget. And one of them said, "Oh," she said, "you need to meditate." And as I was recovering, they just put me in the car and took me to our local center for the Brahma Kumaris. And I was asked, you know, when I got there, they always say, "Why are you here?" You know, I said, "Yeah, I want to learn to meditate." "But there, why? You know, why do you want to learn to meditate?" And I said, "I've forgotten who I am." And so that was my real reason for starting to meditate with the BKs. And that was more than 25 years ago. So that was my reason for coming. There are other reasons that I stay, that I have stayed, but it's become a real part of my life. So let me take a little pause for just a moment and invite you. We've talked a little bit about some of the reasons that we begin to dislike ourselves, our own story. What is the story I tell myself? What are the labels that I may have taken up for myself, or put on myself, or someone else put on me? Or have I even unconsciously put a label or a stereotype on someone else? So let's take a pause. The one of the things I learned from meditation, being with the BKs for 25 years or so, is the power of the pause. And let's do that now. Let's just take a little pause. So take just a moment to think about your own life and the ways in which we might have been influenced by any of those labels. And how one of those labels or those early messages might have grown into a whole story about myself that I tell myself, this is just how I am. I'm this kind of a person, or I'm that kind of a person. You know, what kind of thoughts do I have about my own appearance, my own abilities, the things I've done, or even what I've failed to do? And just take a deep breath. And as you exhale, imagine for a moment the possibility, what it would be like to let all of those burdens go. To be free of the expectations of others. To feel gratitude and appreciation for my own physical body. To literally remove any labels or stereotypes that anyone put on me. Anything that stuck on you, like a name tag, you know, those plastic gummy name tags that you put on. And imagine what it would be like to be open, to be free of those burdens. And just be present. And as you take another breath, just be present now. Let it all go. You know, those things that we carry around with us can be very heavy. And chief among those are expectations by other people and the expectations I put on myself. One person actually said to me once, I feel like I'm carrying a sack of concrete around with me. And literally she did. She actually described it. So let's take these next few minutes. I'd like to share a few tips, maybe tools, that you might use to create, that I might use to create our own profile in courage. I have three suggestions that I've used, actually. I don't know, maybe they'll be helpful for you, that I've used to find myself and to find the courage to be myself and to be with myself. During these days of lockdown, sometimes it's been really hard to be with myself. And so I engage in a lot of distractions and, you know, and so I kind of lose. I'm not very efficient in my work or happy in my life, and I'm just, you know, filling my time with a lot of distractions. But I also use this time to find my own inner strength, my own inner self, in a way that I haven't in all these years. And I think the lockdown has given us the opportunity to do that, even if it's not very comfortable sometimes. So let me share three things. Number one, let me have a sip. Number one, to recognize and release the inner struggle that we have with ourselves. And maybe there are some of you, but honestly, I don't know anyone who doesn't have some kind of an inner struggle going on. There's always some idea that I can be better, I can be more, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. And this sets up a real anxiety and agitation, a sense always that there's something not right. And of course, now we're in a pandemic. So we're like in an environment when many things really aren't right. And so when I add my own sense of not being enough, of not being okay, in that environment, it is a real setup for problems. So let me use these feelings of dislike, whether it's somebody else disliking me or me feeling I'm just not right, I'm not good enough, as a tool for taking me back to myself. And you think about Martin Luther King, who followed Gandhi's nonviolent approach. He wasn't always not so nonviolent. He had many early angry writings and speeches, but he began to study Gandhi and he took up this nonviolent approach. He was disliked. He was disliked by his followers. He was disliked no matter what he did. And of course, ultimately he was assassinated. But he once he found himself, his right place in the nonviolent approach, he brought it to the movement that's still there today. And John Lewis, the Congressman John Lewis, always told the story that his mother, when he was growing up, she would always send him off to school and say, "Don't get in trouble. Don't get in trouble." And he finally, in high school, he disobeyed. And it became his mantra. He said, "Sometimes it's necessary. You have to get in trouble. It's good trouble, necessary trouble." And so his activism, although nonviolent, was good trouble and necessary trouble. So he found himself in that, and boy, was he disliked. So many in the movement felt, in any movement, nonviolent movement, feels that that's the wrong approach, that we should have more of an eye for an eye. And I have to know, even for myself, you know, when I see so many things happening, there's a reaction, there's an immediate reaction that this is wrong, this shouldn't happen. It's you know, anger, just plain anger. So the first tip to recognize and release those feelings, and in myself, it happens to be, you know, a sense of anger, of disappointment, it might be for some. For fear, it might be for a reaction of fear. But underneath all of those, there's usually something about myself. You know, anger is never a primary emotion. And so when a child is angry, when I'm angry, it's not anger that's the problem. It's telling me something about myself. And in my case, it's a sense of unfairness and justice, injustice. And I know this is Black History Month in the UK, and the Black Lives Matter movement all over. One of the things that caught me about it early on, and there's so many things, but one of the things that particularly resonated with me was that they need to be listened to. They need to be heard. And I think one of the things that makes me have a heightened sense of injustice was when I felt I wasn't heard. And so for me, during this particular time, the best thing I can do is listen. But listen with an open heart, not listen tolerating, okay, just have your say, but listen with an open heart. And for me to recognize that here in the US, since 1619, even before we were separate from the UK, from England, slaves were here, brought here. And that equates to something like 12 generations of people who have been less than. And so when people say to me, well, I don't see race, or can't they just get over it? You know, that wasn't me, it's not today. But if you live 12 generations in a particular circumstance, with a particular label, with a particular stereotype, how do you think you'd feel even today? So I think it's really, for me, excuse me, pardon, it's really important to listen and to listen with an open heart. The second thing that I want to mention is to use the situation or the circumstances that you find yourself in like a homeopathic medicine. And I don't know if any of you are using homeopathy, but homeopathic medicines use tiny amount of the virus or the poison to boost our immune system to help us naturally heal ourselves. So trust in the notion that you can heal yourself and you can be disliked without any ill effects. Now, if you dislike yourself, that's a different story, and that really requires an internal healing. But the notion that the body, the mind, can and will and always wants to heal itself is real. There's a Buddhist practice that you might want to check out. It's called Tonglen, and it's a practice of giving and receiving. And the point of it is that in a situation that you might not like or with people that you might not be in aligned with, you disagree with, that using the breath, taking in what's going on and exhaling in a spacious and broad way, you begin to learn to accommodate other people's beliefs, opinions, and so forth without taking them into yourself. It just becomes part of the breathing. So people, you know, I am not a Buddhist practitioner, but I have played a little bit with Tonglen and I found it useful. It's literally sending and receiving. And when we're doing that in an awareness of compassion or kindness, it changes my attitude from dislike to compassion. And that, when we breathe in with that awareness and we breathe out with that relaxation and spaciousness, I benefit, as do all those around me. So I talked about recognizing and releasing, using the situation as a homeopathic medicine. And then the third thing is interrupting our habitual patterns. We all have habitual patterns. I talked about my sense of reaction when I see injustice. Some people try to always smooth things over. Some people like to just avoid conflict at all costs. Others like to engage and have a good argument. Some fight back. But in any case, we all want to make things better somehow. But we have a pattern, a typical pattern for doing that. And we are convinced at some level that if we did that, something would change. If we just, you know, fought back, or if we just avoided conflict, or if we just, you know, tried to smooth things over, things would get better. I'm going to suggest that we try and cultivate a change in attitude about that. But an attitude that whatever is okay, and that there's probably benefit in whatever it is. And when we take a pause, and we take the awareness away from the external things, whatever's going on, into the awareness of myself, away from the other people, back to myself, and remain open, using my breathing, open, spacious, relaxed, free from any burdens. We're not carrying around that heavy sack of concrete of expectations or beliefs or personality traits or any of that. Then I can feel okay and I can relax. And I can be helpful, and I can be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. For myself, I've found that meditation is the greatest way that I've found to actually interrupt those habitual patterns. And it's in meditation that we can learn to stop fighting with myself. Even if I don't fight with other people, I'm still fighting with myself in the sense of wanting something to be different. I can break that pattern of reacting. We can stop struggling with whatever situations are happening or whatever feelings I'm having. And we can stop struggling without making, this is important, we can stop struggling without making the other person or situation the enemy. And what's when somebody becomes the enemy, that conversation breaks down and the relationship is over. So with your permission, if this is okay, we'll like to have a few minutes of reflection and use this opportunity to have your own little relax and refresh. It's the beginning of a weekend, and I can tie up all the situations and things that happen during the week. I'll take these next few minutes to relax and renew myself. Whatever's been troubling me this week, whatever doubts or worries I might have had, any fears I've had, any regrets, any feelings of guilt, I just acknowledge them, that they're here. They may have been taking up space in my mind. And I just imagine, like clouds passing by, I can just let them go. I can even thank them for whatever it is they've been telling me. And just let them pass. I just empty myself of anything or any thoughts that I've been having about what I've been doing today, or what's left to do. And as I take a breath in, I can feel the spaciousness. I can feel the air just filling deeply into my lungs. For these next few moments, I'm free. I'm free of any burden. I'm light. I'm open. My mind is relaxed. I have no thoughts or judgments about anything right now. And if I've had any judgments or any dislike, or if anyone disliked me, let those things become seeds. Seeds for the solution to this. The ground that the seed is planted in is silence. Even if there's a tiny little pause in my day, and I can step into that silence. I can allow my own natural sense of courage to emerge. When I'm with myself, I can feel it. I can feel the courage welling up in me. I recognize that situations come and go, but I am peaceful. I am loveful. I can be compassionate. I am kind. And as I breathe in with the awareness, not only of the challenges facing me, but also those that are facing so many people these days. And as I breathe out, I share that sense of peace, that sense of courage, that sense of love that fills me in a way that I'm overflowing and can share it with all those around me. As I breathe in again, I begin to dissolve any pain I feel for myself or about myself. And I breathe out in a way that dissolves the pain that others may be feeling as well. And in doing that, I join with others who may be doing the very same thing. I'm not alone in this. And in that way, we create together a different world. And I'd like to close this part with a quote from that John Kennedy Profiles in Courage book. He says, in whatever arena of life, one may meet the challenge of courage. Whatever may be the sacrifices he or she faces, if he follows his or her conscience, the loss of friends, the loss of fortune, contentment, even the esteem of others, each must decide for himself or herself the course he will follow. The stories of past courage can define that ingredient. They can teach, they can offer hope, they can provide inspiration, but they cannot supply the courage itself. For this, each one must look into his or her own soul. So thank you for allowing me to share a little bit of my story and my personal tips, what I've done along the way. And I hope that some of this has been helpful. RT, I think back to you. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to.
Yes, there's a few coming in right now. That was a really lovely meditation. Thank you, Kathy. If the people you dislike, if the people who dislike you are close family, it can be very difficult. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. The first one is that they are your best teachers. And so that tip of using the situation to turn it into the seed of the solution helps you and them. The typically we want the other person to change, but that's generally not going to happen. So I can only change how I react to it. I will say my experience has been that others close to me, if I change, others close to me will join in, typically. It may not happen. It may never happen. For some of the folks who were spent their whole life being criticized and ridiculed and, you know, worse, it may never happen that they'll change. But you can stay stable. You can always change. And the key to that for me has been to have a regular practice. Whatever your practice is, even if it's something, you remember our mothers used to say, you know, count to 10 before you speak. That's the power of the pause. Cultivate that pause and start little and generate. Here's something, a little tip for use with children and adults who really feel terrible about themselves. You don't say, well, just stop it, you know, just feel better about yourself. It's a cultivated thing and it's hard. So you can suggest to someone that you open a door for someone, hold a door open for someone. And just that experience, someone will say, thank you. Just that experience of being appreciated, of being thanked, really helps them feel better about themselves. And it's a very small thing. So start small, try something little.
It's interesting, very useful, very practical there. Next question. What steps have you taken to channel your anger created by injustice?
Well, two things. Number one, I have a regular practice of meditation. If I didn't, I don't know where I'd be. It forces me to keep a regular practice. I can't emphasize enough the necessity of a regular practice, whatever it is. If you pray, if you say the rosary, if you go to church, if whatever it is, small things done, and I always remember one of our friends here in Miami said, small things done consistently over time yield big results. And I found that to be really, really true. So a consistent practice, number one. Number two, sometimes I believe you have to put your body where your beliefs are. And so, yes, I do. I do participate. I am an activist, but I'm not an angry activist anymore, because I realized nothing changes with anger. And I try and have my presence be a peaceful presence, a presence that holds the space for others who may be angry. And I listen and I allow it. I allow them to be heard and I support their being heard without, you know, getting all preachy myself. I don't know if that would help.
Where do you start the healing process if you dislike yourself?
Oh boy. That's a lifelong process. It came to me late in life, actually, and I will say that it came not accidentally. I did a silent retreat in Oxford, actually, a few years ago. And there was a level at which you cognitively know. I personally had some trauma and abuse as a child. You cognitively know what happened, but those feelings stay with you for a long time. And it wasn't until I could allow, so that was my first tip, you know, recognize and allow those feelings. And you have to do that in a space that's safe. You have to do that among people who will understand what you're doing, and whether, you know, you need to do it in a professional counseling situation or, you know, you have to do it in a safe space. That's all I'll say. But it takes time. It's not like one and done. And once those feelings, even yesterday, I'm aware of some of those feelings that got triggered. And I say, why am I getting so upset over this? So, and then I have to have some self-compassion. So these are all elements, but it's a slow process.
Does it have to be a painful process?
That's a very good question. I think for me, I think there is pain attached to it, but what changes is that the pain will dissolve. The pain can be released, and you begin putting distance from between yourself and the pain. Whether it's physical, you know, I broke my leg, let's say, there's a lot of pain related to that. But as I heal, it will diminish. Same thing with emotional pain. As I can put some distance between the pain and myself, it will diminish. And as I began, I talked about my own stroke. Well, it changed my life in a thousand ways, but I now say it was a stroke of luck. So I'm not saying, oh, I didn't lose. But, you know, it becomes a vehicle, a method for me doing something different that's more in line with who I am. And being comfortable with it.
Thank you. That's very honest. Next question. Earlier in your talk, you talked about imagining who you are if you didn't have those labels, or if you were free from having those labels. What if you can't imagine who you would be without those labels? Do you have any tricks or exercises that will help me in that journey?
That's an excellent question. I had that problem too. I said, I can't imagine, you know. I didn't think I was very creative. And that's part of what attracted me to ballet too, RT, as you mentioned earlier. Cultivate your creativity and pretend. Just pretend. You lose the sense of play that kids naturally have. And I have a friend who started painting in her 60s. Never knew she could draw or did. And now she's found this was a way of expression. So anything creative, what I'm hearing in that question is I don't know how to express it. You know, I'm sort of, I can't imagine it. These are things I can't express. So have the intention of sparking your creativity, listen to music, you know, read poetry, things that spark that. Do ballet.
Well, I think you've inspired many to try ballet, regardless of our ability.
Try meditation too. Try meditation.
Okay, thank you. This last question is a bit cheeky, I think. I will ask it this once, but possibly never again. And the question is, how do you, or anyone for that matter, stay calm when living under a President Trump?
Oh, that's a perfect question for me.
Or any other president or prime minister currently.
Well, someone who knows me must have asked that. It's the same question, you know, as how do you handle yourself when you're in close proximity, your family or your close friends who dislike you or disagree with you because of your beliefs. You know, I have had some strained relationships in these past 4 years. I'll say two things. One is that this attitude change I have to have, is that everything is accurate. It's okay. What's happening? It's not good. Many people are suffering. And for me, I work every day to be a strong enough person to hold both in my awareness. One is the terrible things that are happening. There is no reason, in my opinion, it's my opinion, that the United States or the UK should, you know, and I'll only speak in my country because this is where I am, we should be in this situation. We have far too many resources, far too much expertise, far too much drive, you know, to get things done to have this happen here. It's a very, very bad situation we're in politically, in my opinion. But at the same time, it's given me this opportunity to study ballet, to really get to the heart of some of the things that bother me, because every single day, I always say, you know, there were years when we would go for years without even thinking about who the president was. Some wouldn't even know who the president was, but there's not a day now that we're not in our face, what he's doing, what he's saying, what's happening, because it's a very difficult situation. And when I see, you know, forget the president right now, we have, you know, over more than 210,000 people who have died in this country. We're losing more than 1,000 people a day to this pandemic. There's no end in sight. And people are suffering, you know, unemployment. We're in a pandemic, in the middle of an economic downturn, in the middle of a social unrest. And this is the big challenge right now. So every day is my opportunity to be totally aware. And I do work in this field, so I'm very aware of it, to hold that and at the same time hold myself steady. I don't always manage so well. But if I do, if I've seen too much news or I get too distracted and caught up in it, I have to take the pause and get back. So, you know, being here with you tonight is a great opportunity for me to get back to the center. It's not a one and done, you know, it's like a balance board. You're always doing it. You're always doing it. And if you ever did a balance board or teeter-totter, you know, the closer you are to the center, the more stable you are. So wish us well.
Wow, thank you. And the person who's asked this is saying they value your leveled response. And I'm going to say, I shouldn't have said it was a cheeky question. I think it is extremely relevant in our lives today. So thank you for asking the question. Kathy, the chat section is flowing continuously with lots and lots of thank yous. People have really enjoyed the talk and taken from it. One person actually had to leave early, and they wrote that just that 30 minutes with you was very healing. And that's just some of the things that have been said. So thank you very, very much. I'm going to thank the audience for joining us. And Kathy, we're going to have to get you back at some point.
No, y'all come to Miami. I can't wait to come back to London.
We look forward to having you. And who knows, we might turn up on your doorstep. So
that would be great. That'd be great. We're happy to have you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I thank everybody for joining us. And we will see you again soon. Good night.